It's Tuesday, September 1, 2015. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The more things change, the more things stay the same. The biblical worldview reminds us that primal temptations simply don't go away. Even though there are new technological platforms and there are new delivery systems for sin and temptation, the reality is sin remains very, very basic. And at the root of sin is the temptation to idolatry. And that becomes very clear, oddly enough, in not just one article, but in a series of articles that have appeared just in recent days in the New York Times. Here's one that appeared yesterday. It's by Kenneth Rosen. The headline is this: Militants Damage a Temple in Palmyra. As Rosen reports, a week after reports of destruction by Islamic State militants in the ancient city of Palmyra in Syria, fighters severely damaged the Temple of Baal there, one of the oldest and culturally significant in the region, according to activists. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, an activist and monitoring group based in Britain, said Sunday that Islamic State fighters had destroyed part of the nearly 2,000-year-old temple. So what's going on here is the destruction of what archaeologists consider to be a very valuable, indeed an invaluable, ancient archaeological site. It is a temple that was built in AD 32, and it was a temple that was built for idolatrous worship. Now, there's no theological concern on the part of the New York Times. There's also no theological concern on the part of the archaeologists and those who are concerned about the destruction of what's recognized as a World Heritage Site, that is, this ancient temple. But you'll notice with a biblical understanding that this isn't just any temple. Rosen gets straight to this when he writes, "Consecrated in AD 32 to the Semitic god Baal, the temple was a source of pride for Syrians and stood not far from where the other building, the Temple of Baal Shamin, was destroyed." Now, both of these ancient temples, one now destroyed and the other now damaged by the Islamic State, represent a name familiar to anyone familiar with the scripture, and that is the name Baal, B-A-A-L, found throughout the Old Testament in terms of the warnings to ancient Israel that they are not to follow the idolatrous worship of Baal. They are not even to take over the worship sites of Baal and consecrate them to Jehovah. Instead, they are to have nothing to do with Baal whatsoever. Many people have heard his name pronounced as Bel, but it's actually a diphthong. It is actually Baal. And Baal was an ancient fertility god, understood as the god of power who spoke in thunder, in terms of the deities of the Canaanites. So someone in the year 2015, reading this headline in the New York Times, may think that that kind of theological issue is safely in terms of our prehistory, back there millennia ago. Even some Christians who are reading the Old Testament will assume that perhaps the idolatrous temptation is something that was limited back to the time of the Old Testament, without recognizing that it is a persistent and enduring temptation. It continues, of course, in the New Testament, and it continues until now. But Christians have to understand the irony of having the idol named Baal all of a sudden show up in terms of the current edition of the New York Times. And we also need to note that even though the New York Times is not driven by any theological concern, the Islamic State was. The Islamic State particularly targeted this temple and the temple they destroyed before it, also consecrated to the worship of Baal, because of the idolatry that was represented in these ancient sites. Christians looking at this headline also need to remind ourselves that idolatry is at the very root of sin. Paul in Romans chapter 1 describes sin as exchanging the worship of the Creator for the creature. You don't have to go to Palmyra in Syria, and you don't have to go back to Mount Carmel in the Old Testament to find the reality and the threat of idolatry. Nor do you have to go beyond page A4 in yesterday's edition of the New York Times. You could go to page A8. Here's the headline in an article by Swati Gupta: Indian scholar who criticized worship of idols is killed. This isn't about ancient history. This is about the last few days in India. Gupta writes, an Indian scholar whose criticism of idol worship had angered religious groups was fatally shot Sunday, according to police. The killing of the scholar, the report says, drew immediate comparisons to a 2013 murder of another professor who had spent decades, quote, debunking gurus, sorcerers, healers, and godmen, end quote. According to the report, the professor who was murdered on Sunday had angered followers of the Lingayat Hindu sect over his assessment in a scholarly work of the sect's founder. As the article says, and I quote, as the criticism escalated to denunciations and then threats, the professor eventually renounced his findings. According to the International Business Times, an Indian publication, the professor said at the time, quote, I did it to save the lives of my family, but I also committed intellectual suicide on that day, end quote. So in the modern age, we're tempted to think that idolatry is something safely in our past. Here on page A8, again of yesterday's edition of the New York Times, is a second story on idolatry in the very same edition of the newspaper. This having to do with a professor in India assassinated for his criticism of idolatry. Not in the past, but in the present. And in terms of the fact that theology is always barely under the headlines, consider another article from the New York Times yesterday, another headline story. This one was found in the print edition on page A9. We're just 9 pages into one edition of this newspaper. And the headline here is, North America's tallest peak will again be called Denali. Reporter Julie Hirschfield Davis tells us that Mount McKinley, as it has been known for a century, named after the assassinated 25th president of the United States, is now going to be known by the name by which it was called by Native Americans, and that is Denali. The Obama administration announced over the weekend that the name change would be made by executive order. As Davis reports, the Central Alaskan Mountain has officially been called Mount McKinley for almost a century. In announcing that Sally Jewell, the Secretary of the Interior, had used her power to rename it, Mr. Obama was paying tribute to the state's native population, which has referred to the site for generations as Denali, meaning the High One or the Great One. But then listen closely to the next paragraph in the New York Times, quote, "The peak at more than 20,000 feet plays a central role in the creation story of the Koyukon Athabascans, a group that has lived in Alaska for thousands of years," end quote. According to academic articles on this particular Native American people, they had associated Denali with the creation of the world, and in particular, the creation of animal species. According to their understanding of creation, all the animals were made out of human beings who were transformed into these various animal forms. The Great Mountain Denali, we are told, is central to that story, and Native Americans have been putting pressure for years upon the government to go back to the name by which they had known that mountain long before the Russians first and the Americans second arrived. The Americans, of course, buying Alaska from the Russians and then naming its highest peak for President William McKinley. Now, by action of the Obama administration, it is Denali again. And once again, we understand that thinly, shallowly under the headlines is a matter of very intense theological interest. The name Denali, it turns out, is not just the name of a mountain. It is central to the creation story of these ancient Native American peoples. In other words, it's a part of their theology. And thus, there is a theological dimension to the renaming of this mountain. It's not just about a name, and it's not just about the right to claim the name. But finally, on this issue, it's one thing to point to this kind of theological confusion, even outright idolatry, when it comes to many people that are distant from us in space and time. It hits a little closer to home to consider a front-page story over the weekend in the Times where the headline is this: "Seeing freedom in their future, psychics reveal all. It's a scam." Michael Wilson, and remember this is a front-page article, in the New York Times says, "Is it real or a bunch of baloney? It's a question New Yorkers and visitors to the city may ask themselves when they pass any of the seemingly countless storefront fortune tellers." Cecilia Mitchell, age 38, was pointedly asked the exact question last year. "What is the psychic business? Is it all real or a bunch of baloney?" She answered, "It's a scam, sir." "The whole thing is a scam?" "Yes." The reporter goes on to say that Mitchell would know. She herself was a psychic, but after making a living portraying herself as a vessel of supernatural powers, she was coming clean. She's coming clean because she had to come before the parole board in New York State, hoping to get out of prison, having been convicted of crimes related to stealing from the public by means of her psychic foretelling. It turns out she couldn't foretell when she was going to be arrested, and as she later told the parole board, it was entirely a scam. She was making it up all along. Now, why in the world would this story make the front page of the New York Times? What has to do with the fact that this is not only quirky and interesting, it's also relevant economically. It turns out that an incredible number of Americans are paying a lot of money to have their fortunes told by those who claim to be able to see the future. But when they're trying to get out of prison, and when they appear before the parole board, these psychics admitted they're not psychics at all. There's nothing to it. They were making it up. It's all a scam. The article tells about one so-called psychic, 26 years old, who was charged with taking $713,000 from a marketing professional from Brooklyn, quote, after promising to reunite him with a woman he loved even after the man discovered that the woman had died, end quote. According to this article, she's in jail awaiting trial. Wilson then tells us that reviews of transcripts from several parole hearings in recent years shine a light behind the hanging beads of the psychic parlor. The inmates' reflections on their careers may give pause, he says, to the passerby willing to pay $20 or $50 or more, as we now know, a whole lot more, for a promised peek at the future. The story says another psychic convicted of grand larceny, she's named Betty Vlado, age 46, called herself a gypsy and said she started out reading tarot cards. Was it useless, a commissioner asked her in her 2014 parole hearing? Yes, pretty much. She was then asked, are you pretty much just telling a story, basically lying, just making stuff up? Yes. Three friends entered her shop in the Upper East Side of Manhattan in 2011. She recalled one of them in particular, quote, she was telling me her problems and I pretty much took advantage of that, end quote. The reporter said, quite obviously, she may be selling herself short. She convinced one woman to pay her $14,500 for a rock she said came from a meteorite that she had obtained from a NASA insider. One of the most interesting confessions made by these psychics trying to get out of prison is the fact that they were listening to their customers, and from what they heard from their customers, they made up the future that the customer wanted to hear. The parole board asked one of these psychics, quote, you don't think there's any legitimate psychics out there, end quote. The response, quote, if they're taking your money, they're not for real, end quote. The biblical warnings against idolatry and against sorcery are abundantly clear, and it's very tempting for us to think in the modern age that's something that can be dismissed in the ancient past, separated from us by miles and miles and centuries. But as it turns out, it's not so separate from us after all. First of all, in time, it comes racing at us in a single edition of the New York Times. And then it comes racing at us when we recognize how many of our neighbors evidently are paying money to soothsayers and to psychics in order to hear what they want to hear. We are living in an increasingly secular age, but that doesn't mean it's not an age marked by spirituality. It's just an age that continually now celebrates a false spirituality. The biblical worldview underlines the fact that we are made in God's image and we will worship something. If we do not worship the one true and living God, then we will worship something. That's the testimony that comes from the ancient temple to Baal that made the headlines of the New York Times just in recent days. It's a headline that comes to us in the same newspaper about the psychic who could be operating right down the street and those who are paying that psychic money in order to hear the future they want to know. A generation ago, Bob Dylan wrote a song, Gotta Serve Somebody. That's true. You gotta serve somebody. You gotta worship somebody too. That comes to us fresh in the headlines. Next, as we're observing the culture being transformed right before our eyes, I was preaching in Indianapolis, Indiana on Sunday, and I looked at the local Indianapolis paper. The lead headline editorial is a full page, half of the page, just artwork for the editorial. That's very, very unusual. Here's the editorial headline, quote, Equal Rights for All. It's time for Indiana to act. The editorial board of the Indianapolis Star, not one of the most liberal newspapers in America, is nonetheless calling for the inclusion of sexual orientation and gender identity in anti-discrimination legislation there in the state of Indiana. Indiana is one of those states that represents mainstream America. If you will have this kind of development in Indiana, then you'll have it anywhere. That's what makes the story so interesting. It's also interesting that the Indianapolis Star thought that this was the right time to run the editorial, and they ran it in such a graphic way. A massive statement in terms of the editorial board of their own intention to influence the legislation there in Indiana. They write, quote, last spring at the height of controversy surrounding the passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the Indianapolis Star called for expansion of Indiana's civil rights law to include sexual orientation and gender identity. We plan, they wrote, to follow up this fall with an editorial board campaign aimed, they say, at convincing the state legislature to adopt this law. Now, here you have a newspaper announcing that it's going to be launching an editorial board campaign. That's their word for it, in order to see the moral revolution in Indiana now recognized in terms of the law they demand. We've been tracking how the collision between sexual liberty or erotic liberty on the one hand and religious liberty on the other is being increasingly shaped and formed by the elites in the United States, for whom, if there is a direct collision, it is religious liberty that will have to lose. You'll also recall that in the very opening words of this editorial, the editorial board went back to the spring when Indiana's legislature had passed and the governor signed into law a form of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it was this newspaper that called for an immediate revision to that law in order to a significant extent to gut that legislation of its religious liberty protections. In this editorial, they make an amazing statement. Quote, and as defenders of the First Amendment, we believe deeply in religious freedoms, but protections for all and religious freedom can coexist, end quote. The remarkable thing about those two sentences is that they are not explained in any way. The editorial board actually doesn't take the responsibility to try to even define what they mean by religious liberty, and they're absolutely intellectually dishonest in suggesting, even as they began their editorial with reference back to the legislative controversy of the spring, that, as they stated again, quote, protections for all and religious freedom can coexist, end quote. That means that they are redefining religious freedom. They may claim to protect and to respect religious liberty, but when they write the editorial this way and they announce they are beginning an editorial board campaign, it's clear that, once again, when there's a collision between erotic liberty and religious liberty, in the view of this editorial board, and that should tell us a great deal coming from Indianapolis, Indiana, it's religious liberty that's going to have to give way. And finally, the editorial board ends on a statement that also demonstrates a very clear example of the kind of intellectual dishonesty we're increasingly hearing across this country. The editorial board says they call for a state, quote, where discrimination is not tolerated in any form, end quote. Now, what in the world would that mean? A society that has no discrimination whatsoever? That's an incoherent society. They're actually not calling for a state in which there's no discrimination whatsoever. They're calling for a state that doesn't discriminate where they don't want it to discriminate. But they profoundly do want a state that does discriminate where they think discrimination should continue. They say they want a state in which discrimination isn't tolerated in any form, but that would be moral anarchy. We make discriminations all the time. When a parent hires a babysitter, you better hope they're making discriminations as to which babysitter is more morally qualified than another. If you're not discriminating at all, then you would simply hire anyone to be the babysitter for your children. You would hire anyone to be the teacher in the classroom. You would hire anyone or trust anyone with anything. You would furthermore, when it comes to sexual morality, if you're not discriminating at all, you would endorse polygamy or any number of other arrangements, but that's not what the editorial board is doing. Here you see the kind of language that is used as mere propaganda. It's not a serious moral argument. When someone tells you that they want to live in a state that doesn't discriminate at all, or to use their exact language, a state where discrimination is not tolerated in any form, recognize that that means opening up all the jails. Recognize that statement for what it is, an irresponsible and dishonest moral claim, but one that looks good as the final sentence in your editorial. Meanwhile, on the issue of polygamy, in the aftermath of the Obergefell decision by the Supreme Court back at the last of June, we talked about the fact that the majority opinion in that decision, the decision that legalized same-sex marriage across the United States, we talked about the fact that that majority opinion by Justice Anthony Kennedy opened the door wide to polygamy, precisely because it didn't close that door. Furthermore, the very arguments used by Justice Kennedy and the five-person majority in that case also point to the inevitable acceptance and normalization, indeed the legalization of polygamy in some form in the future. Now, Reuters tells us that in a very real case, now before the 10th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, the very arguments used in the Obergefell decision are being used in favor of polygamy. Oftentimes, when you see a legal precedent set that you know will lead to something else, it takes some time to get there. Let's just note the fact that we're talking about the distance on the calendar just from June until September. Jonathan Turley, the attorney in this case for the polygamist, in his arguments to the court said, quote, it is clear that states can no longer use criminal codes to coerce or punish those who choose to live in consensual but unpopular unions, end quote. By unpopular unions, he's talking here about polygamy. In this case, the arguments are being made for a man and his so-called wives who are the stars of the reality television show Sister Wives. As Reuters tells us, the TLC television network first aired Sister Wives in 2010, and it begins a new season next month. The Brown family, as it is known, and their 17 children, who formerly lived in Lehi, Utah, are now living in Las Vegas and are members of the Apostolic United Brethren, a Utah-based church, says the article, that follows plural marriage doctrine, or polygamy. And so years ago, as the arguments for same-sex marriage were beginning to be discussed in the public square, many of us warned that it wouldn't stop with same-sex marriage, that polygamy and any number of other things would be close behind. And yet, to be honest, none of us really saw it be this close behind. And then when the decision was actually handed down this past June, the decision in terms of its arguments was actually even worse than many of us had expected. And Anthony Kennedy, once again, writing for the majority, really did leave the door wide open for the legalization of polygamy. Now Jonathan Turley, one of the most influential lawyers in America, is rushing in to do just that, to put polygamy before the nation's highest courts. And this isn't something in the abstract future. We're talking already about the court level just before the Supreme Court of the United States. In this case, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. By the way, before we leave this, we need to note that the Sister Wives folks are not at court because they lost the case at the lower level, but they won it. It's the state of Utah that's appealing. The lawyers and others arguing for the legalization of same-sex marriage were making the case that it is a horrible form of discrimination to say that marriage has to be and can only be the union of a man and a woman. Now, just as predicted, are those who are showing up at court, some of the highest courts in the land, to argue that it is an improper discrimination, an act of odious and unconstitutional discrimination to say that marriage can only be limited to the number two. I just have to wonder what the editorial board of the Indianapolis Star really thinks when it comes to stating that they want to live in a state where discrimination is not tolerated in any form. The headline on the polygamy case reminds us that they just might get, sooner than they might think, what they asked for. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. Theological training is so important to gospel ministry, and where you receive training is also urgently important. As you consider God's call on your life, we want to give you the opportunity to experience Southern Seminary at Preview Day on October the 16th. For just $25, we'll cover your two nights of lodging as well as all of your meals on Preview Day. For more information, visit www.sbts.edu/preview. And look forward to meeting you then. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.